This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon death row inmate Gary Haugen continues his fight for the right to be executed in Oregon's Supreme Court.
Portland students stage a school walkout as part of a national protest against standardized testing.
And a U.S. Senate committee holds a hearing on sexual assault in the military.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 14th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Convicted murderer Gary Haugen is in the Oregon Supreme Court today, calling on the state to execute him. Haugen is challenging Governor John Kitzhaber's decision to declare a moratorium on executions in the state. Haugen's attorney will argue in front of the Oregon Supreme Court that the governor exceeded his authority when he issued a temporary reprieve on his execution last November. The governor claims that his authority to invoke clemency is absolute and has stated that he wants the state legislature to put the issue of abolishing the death penalty on the ballot for voters to decide.
Rob Kilgore, the administrator of Oregon Corrections Enterprises, or OCE, was fired by the State Corrections Department today. He accuses the department of retaliating against him for blowing the whistle on questionable spending and executive favors within the prison system. OCE runs factories and work centers in 8 Oregon prisons and is semi-independent from the state. Their administrator is hired and fired by the Corrections Department, but their budget and operations are run separately. An investigation by the State Justice Department in February found evidence of corrections officials receiving favors from OCE. Favors included donations to certain charities, private use of furniture, and nepotism, but no explicitly illegal activity was found. Director of Corrections, Colette Peters, accused Kilgore of going against her wishes by commissioning a study of prison industries by Portland State University, using an independent attorney, and also causing low morale within the company. Kilgore dismisses these reasons and maintains that it was his whistleblowing that got him fired. The PSU study he commissioned urgently recommended that the governor clarify the relationship between the Corrections Department and the head of OCE. Kilgore said, quote, "It's not an easy program to run, this mix of business, prisons, and politics."
The Portland City Council has agreed to pay $50,000 to a motorcycle rider who was injured in an accident with a Portland police vehicle. The item was on the consent agenda, so there was no discussion or public comment, but an investigation by the Portland Mercury found that the officer involved has a long history of irresponsible behavior, which has cost the city quite a lot of money. Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch says that Officer Jason Lobau is representative of a problematic culture among the Portland police.
Officer Jason Lobau is his name, and we've actually featured his own words in our newsletter, The People's Police Report, numerous times over the years because he used to write for the Police Association's newsletter, which is called The Rap Sheet. And he's made numerous comments that are, I would say, disturbing, to say the least, regarding civilians, regarding police accountability advocates, regarding the idea that torture that was used on the show 24 with Agent Jack Bauer is something that he thought that should be used in real life, things like that. And he once called out a civil rights attorney in town who was balding a little bit on top and said, "Hey, I've got two words for you, Rogaine." And he thought that was just hilarious. So this guy's been involved in a lot of things, and apparently he was suspended for 20 days. From the force at one point, which is fairly serious. So it feels as though here's a problem officer with a chip on his shoulder, and he was involved in an accident where apparently he was going through a red light without his emergency lights on and crashed a guy on his motorcycle. and caused totaled the motorcycle, according to the documents that were at City Council. And I actually testified to this in January. They heard the replacement money for the motorcycle separately from the the personal injury money that was heard on Wednesday morning. So there was $11,000 to replace the motorcycle. And I, at the time, I said, wasn't this person injured if his motorcycle was wiped out? But I think the more important question I raised, which I haven't gotten an answer to, is there an investigation going on into whether Officer Lobaugh violated policy when he did this? And the City Council didn't reply, and I don't know if we will ever know if that's happening.
That was Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch speaking about the City Council compensating a man who was struck by a police vehicle.
Students from Portland Public Schools throughout the district walked out of classes just after 11 this morning to announce their dissatisfaction with standardized testing. The demonstration is part of a national protest. Alexia Garcia, student representative of the Portland Public School Board, spoke during a press conference held at Grant High School before she departed for Salem. Once in the Capitol, she and other students plan to lobby support from state legislators for House Bill 2664, which provides the legal framework to opt out of having test scores as the determining factor for graduating. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Garcia after the rally.
So the idea is that we're taking a strong stance against standardized testing. We don't like that they're used in evaluation of our schools and our teachers. We don't like that the scores have a really high correlation with race and class. We don't like the idea that you can quantify someone's knowledge. And as a whole, it's a really expensive program that we'd like to see that money be spent on things like teachers and classroom things that directly benefit students.
Hello, I'm Hallie Steiner, and I go here to Grant High School. I just want to share a personal anecdote about the Oaks testing, which is what we're boycotting today. When I was a junior, I believe, or maybe a sophomore, I took the science test, and if this is supposed to be testing my knowledge of science, then it is very arbitrary and not useful. It tested me on astrology and on earth science, two subjects I've never taken. I guessed on every question, and I got an exceeding score. How is this testing students' knowledge of what we're learning in schools? If they're testing us on things that maybe has been cut by budgets or affected by budget cuts or that we aren't learning, I don't think the district should be spending $17 million on administering a test that is not useful. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Skylar Holt, and I am a senior from Jefferson High School. If I would have had the knowledge about state testing and opting out my sophomore year, I wouldn't have taken these tests. And yes, I passed all the ones to graduate, but they don't show proper knowledge. And I wish more students could be here to represent the ones who aren't passing, the seniors who could possibly not graduate because of this test. So I'm standing here in solidarity with Lincoln and Cleveland and all the other students who have opted out because I think it's the right thing to do. And just thank you for coming.
I feel it's a waste of resources and class time and to spend an entire week testing students on something which doesn't even really matter for their future. It doesn't even give them critical thinking skills. It lumps it into small boxes, and you can't think outside of the answers given to you on the test, which is not how life works. There's many answers to everything, and we need to find these, and working on answering standardized multiple choice test questions is not working these skills. It's not working critical thinking or any of the things that schools are supposedly supposed to promote. So I say opt out of standardized testing, and we need to find a better alternative.
Hi, my name is Paul Wells. I'm actually an alumni from Grant High School. I just want to say that as, you know, alumni, it sucks to see the fact that another generation is going into Grant High School having to take these tests and waste their class time. I had a lot of great times in the school, and the best times I had were not when I was taking tests or studying for tests. It was the relationships I was forging with my teachers and with the people around me.
This is Robin Ryan with KBOO News. I'm standing here with Alexia Garcia, and we've just completed the walkout. They're headed for Salem. When do you expect to be back?
Probably today, around 4 or 5.
I was also in attendance at the most recent board meeting. Mm-hmm. You are the student representative on the board.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What did you say to them about standardized testing? Did you not give them some indication that action was coming?
In one of my student reports, I explained the campaign and explained what would be going on with the students opting out. So PPS has been sending out some things that are saying standardized testing is a valuable learning tool and basically trying to counter our campaign. So I've kind of responded to a lot of the things they were saying and like explained where we're coming from.
So their response to your statement at the last board meeting was to kind of reiterate the value as they see it of the test?
They sent out a flyer to every family in the mail and basically said, this is a key learning tool, like it's really valuable to students. And I mean, we don't necessarily see that at all, and like clearly the students are taking a stand against it. So I think,
and who do you think that should be up to?
I think it definitely should come down to like what the students and teachers want, and if they're both saying like this isn't benefiting our system, this is wasting class time and like incorrectly labeling our schools, then I think we should definitely have a voice in the process. And I think currently with these national and state requirements, we are like pretty limited from having that voice.
What do you think is the most destructive bit of impact of this process on the academic environment?
It's a mixture of like how much money goes into it. So basically you have these state requirements that say like you need to have standardized testing, and then the governor's just required that we have all this like sort of data analysis and goal setting for how well students perform on the testing, and it ends up costing like almost $20 million, I'm pretty sure is the number. And with that, it's like we're locked down in paying for those things when we're cutting teachers. So it seems like especially right now during a time of budget cuts, we cannot be affording the system. These tests have a high correlation with race and income, and you have neighborhoods built up around income, then you have these schools that naturally are going to not perform as well on the tests. And that kind of leads them to be labeled as failing. And then you see like this white flight and people trying to transfer out of the schools. And it doesn't mean that their teachers are worse or that their classes are worse. It's just like a stigma that's created. And I think that's had huge impacts on people transferring out of PPS or transferring to like upper middle class schools.
How do you see feeding into the bigger picture privatized and charter schools?
I think one, with Race to the Top, the idea that you need to have winners and you need to have losers kind of is not benefiting our society, in that like you should be wanting to educate everyone. And I think with that, you get these schools that are labeled failing, people transferring out, schools being closed down because they don't have high enough enrollment, then people will either transfer to charters or transfer to private schools. And so it's definitely all like supporting this movement to privatization of education.
But education is under attack. What do we do?
Stand up like that!
Good education.
That was Robin Ryan speaking to Alexia Garcia, student representative of the Portland Public Schools Board, following a student walkout throughout Portland this morning intending to bring to light issues about standardized testing.
Guerrilla Capital, a Eugene firm that deals in foreclosed homes, has reported that court-supervised foreclosures have risen compared to this time last year. Oregon's seven largest counties saw legal action brought against 996 properties by banks in February, most of which involved foreclosures. That's a 65% increase from January, and almost matches the number of out-of-court foreclosure starting in February of 2012. Foreclosing through legal action is a more expensive alternative than simply filing the action with the county, but it sidesteps two important developments in the past year. First, an appellate court decision found that mortgage lenders must keep track of the mortgage's ownership records, which complicates the county filing process. Then, a state law created a foreclosure mediation program to work with banks and at-risk homeowners. By taking foreclosure proceedings before a judge, lenders avoid the court ruling and the mediation program. The mortgage industry is currently lobbying the state legislature to relax the mediation requirements, while consumer advocates such as Economic Fairness Oregon are lobbying to have judicial foreclosures covered by the mediation program as well.
Dale Matlock and Tasha Gall are seeking a malpractice suit against Dr. Sean Goodman and Legacy Emanuel Medical Center for an incorrect surgery performed on their son in 2011. The boy, Jesse Matlock, had a wandering right eye that needed corrective eye surgery. When he went in for the surgery, however, the doctor performed the operation on the left eye instead. After realizing her mistake, Dr. Goodman repeated the surgery on the correct eye, but without consulting the parents. Dr. Goodman is not an employee of the hospital, but was using the facilities of Legacy Emmanuel Medical Center in Portland for the surgery. The hospital wants to settle the case out of court for up to $50,000, but the parents are not satisfied with this offer. They want the hospital to publicly admit fault, which in this case the hospital is unwilling to do.
Labor activists across the country are engaging in rolling one-day hunger strikes in solidarity with General Motors workers in Colombia. In Portland, over the last week, a number of supporters have taken the challenge of engaging in one-day solidarity fasts. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Portland labor activist Greg Margolis.
I wonder if you could tell us about this rolling fast.
As some folks know, there are auto workers in the General Motors plant in Bogota, Colombia, who have been on a vigil for over a year and a half and have had several hunger strikes because up to 200 workers have been fired for injuries that they obtained on the job as a result of repetitive actions and heavy lifting and those sorts of things. And instead of being given compensation and medical attention and retraining, they were fired. And so part of their fight back is to do this fast, and folks have been doing a solidarity fast over the last couple of years. And recently, for I think today would be the 15th weekday in a row, individuals are fasting for a day in solidarity, and most of them are preparing a short video, which they're sharing on Facebook and sharing with friends, and also posting on the General Motors Facebook page. So it's a way to continue to get the message out that these workers are standing up for their rights in Colombia, and the same kind of things that are happening to them are happening here and around the world. And so it's emblematic of the fight that we're doing, and their families are suffering beyond what we can comprehend because of the situation there in Colombia, which is the worst labor record on the planet, the most assassinations of labor leaders.
What's been the response of the management of General Motors?
There have been some attempts to negotiate a resolution of this, but essentially for Jorge, for instance, the amount that he would have gotten wouldn't have even paid for his medical expenses and for future surgeries, which he requires, let alone for long-term disability, and it didn't offer retraining, and it was a slap in the face, the offer they made. And the fact that they even made an offer, even though they wouldn't admit it, is an admission of that they are responsible. But they, because it's far away, they think they can just ignore it and kind of give it the back of their hand. But we're going to stay on them until justice is done.
Now, General Motors promotes itself as an American company, that they received bailout money and support from the U.S. government in order to reduce the U.S. dependence on imports. How is it that they have facilities in Colombia that these workers are being exploited in?
Well, they're actually an international company, but for all intents and purposes, they're American, and in fact, they wouldn't be in operation today if it weren't for the taxpayers' bailout, which makes this particularly atrocious. Not that it wouldn't be otherwise, but we, although they're slowly paying back the loan, we still, as to any of us who are taxpayers, citizens of this country, own part of General Motors. So if we're against it here, we should be against it everywhere, because we own part of the company, and that reflects who we are as a people. Three.
Well, thanks very much, Greg Margolis, local labor activist and one of the people who has engaged in a one-day hunger strike in solidarity with workers in Colombia that have worked for General Motors, been injured on the job, and have not been compensated. Again, if you're looking on Facebook, search for Asotrecol, A-S-O-T-R-E-C-O-L. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of afternoon showers and a high near 59 degrees. There's also a chance of showers late tomorrow night, with lows dropping to somewhere near 47 degrees.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer, hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper. And as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention. But it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to votehemp.com.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
CNN Money reports that solar installations in the United States reached record levels in the year 2012. Even though the industry continues to struggle with bankruptcies and other financial problems, the National Solar Industries Association reports that 2012 added the equivalent of 500,000 homes powered by the sun. They credit the jump in installations to the declining price of solar panels, to stable tax incentives, and more options for financing. The solar power industry in the United States now employs 113,000 people, but still it only represents less than 1% of the country's electrical generation. The industry expects to keep growing in the near future, even though the United States Energy Information Administration reports that where substantial government subsidies are not available, the cost of solar electricity is still twice as much as natural gas.
In a letter to the Department of Justice, Aaron Swartz's attorneys allege that U.S. prosecutor Steve Heyman engaged in professional misconduct. Swartz, an internet activist, committed suicide in January during federal prosecution for document theft. He had been arrested and accused of hacking into MIT's computer system and stealing more than 4 million documents from JSTOR, a database of scientific and scholarly articles. Swartz's lawyers argued that prosecutor Heyman withheld exculpatory evidence in the case. At issue is whether Heyman followed proper procedure in turning over evidence and securing a warrant. Heyman had already been under scrutiny for his conduct during the Swartz prosecution. Although Jay Storr has settled with Swartz in 2011, Heyman continued to aggressively pursue and prosecute the case. Swartz's parents felt that Heyman's overly aggressive prosecution of their son contributed to his suicide. Additionally, Quinn Norton, a witness in the grand jury hearing against Swartz, alleged that Heyman was more interested in bringing Swartz down than in the actual facts of the case. Meanwhile, Swartz will be awarded the American Library Association's James Madison Award tomorrow as part of their Freedom of Information Day event in Washington, D.C.
Today, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder appointed Kevin Orr as emergency financial manager to the city of Detroit. Orr is a bankruptcy expert and partner in the Cleveland-based law firm Jones Day. The Associated Press reports it will be his duty to guide Detroit through the financial restructuring of a city burdened with more than $14 billion in long-term debt and a $337 million budget deficit. The decision, approved by Michigan's Emergency Loan Board, has made Detroit the largest United States city to have its finances placed under state control. Kevin Orr spoke about Michigan's history with emergency managers and the priorities he has as emergency financial manager of Detroit.
The role that I'm undertaking is a creature of state statute and has been longstanding. So while I understand there's a lot of concern and emotion behind the concept that I'm depriving people of certain rights, actually is very consistent with both the history of the country and in specific. In this state, emergency managers laws have existed in their current iteration from 1980, which has been almost over 30 years, or from the act that I'm going to be appointed under 1990 for almost 25 years. I would hope that people recognize that in the state, both behind Democratic governors and Republican governors, emergency managers have been appointed in five cities and four school districts. So this is, while unusual and of concern, it's very common. I'd say my top priority is, you know, getting boots on the ground, and use a mixed metaphor, in the saddle, and get to the data. I've obviously been trying to get briefed as best I can on sort of the status, and I've been drinking through a fire hose with a number of different information, but I'd really like to verify the information impressions I have. There are some issues, principally due with delivering services to the consumers and customers of the city, the citizens, that I'd like to get to, and whether that's lighting, enhance public safety and security, enhance EMT response times, things along those lines. That, frankly, would be my first priority. So for the people of Detroit, what they should expect is, I'm going to try to apply, the governor says relentless positive action, I just say I'm going to work through the data. I'm going to try to make reasoned, rational decisions based upon the facts, based upon the need, and the current realities on the ground, which everyone admits and agrees needs to have something done about it.
That was Kevin Orr, who was appointed today as emergency financial manager for the city of Detroit, Michigan.
The United States government has started prosecuting clients of Swiss financial advisor Beta Singerberger. Singerberger accidentally included a list of his U.S. clients in a package he sent to someone in the United States. The list included client contact information and incriminating details of how taxes were avoided. For 11 years, Singerberger helped clients in the U.S. hide $184 million from the IRS. His elaborate schemes involved creating fake foundations and corporations around the world. Singerberger submitted paperwork to the IRS showing the money belonging to the phony business. At the same time, he provided the Swiss government documentation to show his clients as the true owners. Money hidden in Swiss bank accounts is nearly impossible to track down. Assistant U.S. Attorney Dan Levi says this list is the only reason the federal government was able to identify the 60 tax dodgers. Singerberger, who lives in Zurich, was charged in July 2011 with conspiracy to cheat the IRS. However, he has not appeared in a U.S. court. It's unlikely he ever will, because Switzerland does not have an extradition treaty with the U.S.
Florida's Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll resigned this week after she was questioned by law enforcement regarding her connection to a fraudulent veterans charity. KBOO's Matt Maddox has more on this story.
Allied Veterans of the World acted as a front for a $300 million gambling operation, while only donating 2% of that money to actual charities. Former executives spent millions on themselves buying boats, sports cars, and vacation properties. Authorities say they've seized cars, property, and roughly 300 bank accounts containing $65 million. Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll was the co-owner of a public relations firm that worked for Allied Veterans and appeared in a TV advertisement 2 years ago promoting the organization's work on behalf of veterans. Carroll maintains that she and the PR firm are not being investigated. She says she stepped down so that the scandal would not become a distraction for Governor Rick Scott's administration. Formal charges will be filed next week against nearly 60 people involved in the scam. Carroll was criticized when she served as a Florida congressmember for introducing a bill that would have legalized the so-called sweepstakes games, similar to those operated by Allied Veterans. She later withdrew the bill, claiming an aide filed it accidentally. The company operates in a gray area of Florida law. They run nearly 50 internet cafes, each with rows of computers and a sign that reads, quote, "This is not a gaming establishment." Customers purchase prepaid cards and use them at the computers to play online sweepstakes games. Customers then take the cards to the cashier to redeem their prizes as cash. Law enforcement officials say this is just the first part of the investigation. The second part will involve investigations into the money Allied Veterans spent on lobbying and donations to political campaigns. This is Matt Maddox with KBOO News.
Late last month, a sexual assault conviction and dismissal of a former Air Force Inspector General was set aside by the Air Force commander who convened his court-martial, who cited, quote, reasonable doubt. Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkerson had been convicted of aggravated sexual assault in a week-long juried trial last year, discharged from the service with no pay, and sentenced to a year in prison. The actions of the commander was a rare example of case dismissal by convening authorities who have the right to lower penalties in military court cases. In the wake of this controversial event, a Senate Armed Services Committee yesterday held a hearing on sexual assault in the military, which included testimony by several